some of my songs I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's February 22nd, 2011. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43. I'm joined tonight by my co-host, Ray Dieter from the DBA Boys. How are you, Ray?
I'm all right, Jimmy. Looking forward to this show. We got some great guests tonight.
Ray, have you been out of town lately?
I was in New Orleans, Louisiana for the weekend for Crew de Vue. And that's one of the great parades down there in Louisiana in New Orleans. And I had a great time. Great time to get out of town. My first time out of town in a while.
Well, you deserve it. And we'll talk later in the show about your great establishments in New Orleans.
Absolutely.
Let's give a shout out to our sponsor, greatbrewers.com. It's the culmination of information from passionate beer wholesalers who serve over 50,000 beer retailers in 14 states. What does that mean for you? Check out Beer Cloud, a mobile app to help you locate your favorite beers. Check out greatbrewers.com. And we're supported by the people at the Good Beer Seal, an association of 27 New York City good beer bars. Check out goodbeerseal.com and look forward to July Good Beer Month, soon to be declared by Mayor Bloomberg for 2011. If you have any questions, give us a call at 718-497-2128 or email us beersessions@gmail.com. We've got our regular roving reporter, Dave Broderick, and beer maven, Jen Swartman, in the house tonight. How are you guys? Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio.
Thanks, man. Good to be back.
All right. Since in the spirit of our little family here, because we really have a great thing going when we're all in the same room, I'm going to pose a question, and I think we can all talk about it. Who is Tommy Arthur?
Tommy or Tommy?
I don't know. Is it Tommy, Tommy, or
it's Tommy?
It's just spelled like Tommy. It's actually Tommy.
Well, let's talk about this dude. He's got a cool name. He writes for Ale Street News.
Well, he's a brewer.
He's got a cheesy name.
He was the brewmaster head brewer of the first Pizza Port brew pub in Solano Beach, California. So that's in the greater like San Diego coastal area. There are now four Pizza Ports out there, and they are award-winning through and through over and over again. And the cool thing about their operation is that each brew pub has its own brewer who does his own lineup. And so you go to a festival like the Great American Beer Festival, and they've entered all these beers, and it's just a you could spend the entire event just trying all the different beers from all their different breweries.
And how's the pizza?
Pizza's good too.
But
Tommy,
it's not New York pizza though. I'll tell you that. I was a little disappointed, but it's okay. But the beer was more than made up for it.
Yeah, so Tommy Arthur gained a following there, and then he spun off and is still connected to the Pizza Ports. But he started port brewing in Lost Abbey at a facility that was the former Stone Brewery in, I can't remember the specific spot, but it's in the North County of San Diego. And now he does two lines of beer, port brewing, which is more that American style, and then Lost Abbey, which is all the Belgian styles.
Well, the reason we mention his name is there's a great article in the Ale Street News about Belgian-style beer, and he's arguing for the fact that, is there a Belgian style? And he's saying that we should call things Belgian-inspired. Does anybody want to talk about that? Because I think it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was a really good piece, and he had a really great point, that when you do it here, you're drawing inspiration from there. You're not like trying to necessarily recreate exactly what was done over there. You're trying to, you sort of take what they gave you and where they started, and then you kind of go, use those parameters and go in your own direction and make it your own, basically, which is, I think, probably what most brewers do anyway. So that inspired, it's like when you write a book and you're inspired by a certain, by another author, you're not going to copy that author. But you're influenced by that person, and you take inspiration from that person.
Dave, do you think that sometimes some Belgian styles of beer are cliched? Like if someone says that there's a Belgian triple or a Belgian double, you think that some people are kind of stuck in like that what they think the style is supposed to be? Or do you think enough people are able to interpret it in their own way?
You mean, do you think that holds them back a little bit?
Yeah.
From, then that might be what he, I don't know if he was arguing that. But yeah, I mean, some guys could get trapped by that. You know, it's like trying to do it exactly to style, what's done there, rather than just, you know, starting there and then going in your own way. Yeah.
Especially what, well, one of the great things about Belgian beers are proprietary yeast strains. And so, you know, the grain profile that these breweries set up really, you know, it doesn't necessarily have the character behind it. It kind of sets it up. So you can try to mimic that. But if you don't have the proprietary yeast strain, it's not going to taste just like their beer. So that's also an interpretation.
Yeah,
you know, using yeast strains that you make proprietary for your
brewery.
Yeah, they're
so singular, those yeast strains. So
and I always find that every time an American brewer tries to make a lambic ale, it just really doesn't work that well. Maybe there's one out there. I haven't had it. Maybe a home brewer someplace pulled it together.
Spontaneous fermentation is a little tricky to just pull off.
Yeah, and it takes a long... I mean, just, you know, they've been doing it for so long. And
right.
We've just... You know, how long have we been doing it for? So, you know, talk to us in 200 years.
What about like a American brewery like Cascade? Had their creek, the Cascade Creek?
They're doing some great stuff. I mean, it you know, it's definitely coming along. There's some guys doing it really well here, and there's guys that have been doing it over there for a really long time. There's a lot of tradition, but we're coming along.
I remember a couple of years ago, the New Glarus Brewery had a creek was just outstanding.
They still do.
Yeah. Well,
if you make it to Wisconsin.
You just can't get it anymore. Yeah.
Well, you know, I had it out at the GABF, and I loved it. It was, you know, it was tart, and it was wonderful. And then they brought it to this market. They brought it to the New York market, and as soon as I found out they had it, I bought as much as I could so I could sell it at DBA in the East Village. And then I opened a bottle of it, and it was like, this was not the same stuff that I had in
Maybe
Denver.
That's why they pulled from the market. And now, I mean, you can only get New Glarus's beer within the state of Wisconsin, not even in the regional states of the Midwest.
And they've increased their size like tenfold since then, and yet still only within that state. So
that might have been a project that they were... that they regret, you know.
Right. I was very disappointed by it, but I did love it when I first had it out there in Denver.
Oh, yeah, at the GABF, yeah. And people will stand in long lines to get that tiny little one-ounce taste of that beer or any of their beers.
Speaking of Belgian beer, I think we should crack this super special bottle that Jen brought.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah.
So this is from the special collection at Blind Tiger?
Yeah,
I think BR probably dropped it off from
this
Shelton
beer's
Brothers.
Been floating around. This is the first time I've had it with an actual label. I have had it a couple times, and one was at your bar, Jimmy. And what it is, it's from De La Seine Brewery, which is a great brewery out of Brussels. And I'm going to just bumble through these words.
But Dave, tell us, you have a little issue.
I have a little issue here because it's both, it's capped and corked.
Oops.
So
it's
just
a real fancy
beer. We need a wine key.
Brie, our executive producer, just ran through.
Oh, yeah. We'll get to it. So I'll talk about it for a second.
Some real fancy beers actually have a wine cork.
A cap and a cork. Wadesda, number one. And so there's an implication that this will be a series that De La Seine does, but this is the first one, the only one I've had so far. And it's a blend of De La Seine's Belgian triple, which is called the Jamba de Bois, which I can't pronounce anything, which means wooden leg.
You speak French really well.
Yeah, isn't that great? Known for my accent. But
thanks, Jack.
And then
Jack
the blend,
just delivered
it's blended.
A wine key.
Yay.
From Roberta's restaurant.
Jack, our savior.
It's and then it's their Belgian triple blended with a Cantillon lambic. And Cantillon is one of the lambic producers. Great, great sour beers. And that particular lambic was oak aged. Or the whole, I think the whole beer was oak aged. And then bottle fermented.
Well, so. Jen, I was lucky enough to have an advanced copy of this because I met the guys from De La Seine, and they gave it to me last spring.
And
it was the first time I thought I was worthy of you when I
when you pulled that
when I pulled the bottle
pulled that
and
bottle
were,
out and my eyes
happy.
Lit up. I had had it. Yvonne de Beets, who is the brewmaster of De La Seine, happened to stop by Blind Tiger when I was there working, and. Was kind enough to share a bottle with
me. You know what? I've got a bottle. This is my refrigerator from Yvonne. He gave it to me.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
He came
like
the.
I didn't even realize it. Oh wow! Yeah. I'm really happy.
It was like the Pied Piper.
There was
no
label on it. It was this bottle.
Exactly. It was like
no label.
No label. And then the one Jimmy had a piece of masking tape with Sharpie marker that had, and then this one has a real label, but.
Yeah, and De La Zen is Brussels' newest brewery.
Are they officially?
Although
Avon's
been around for a while.
They've got their own location now.
Yep.
Oh, wow, that's big news.
And they just doubled the number of breweries in Brussels to two, from one to two. Cantillon was the only one before. Mm-hmm. And so it's a pretty big deal. And they could have had their own brewery a lot sooner if they had been willing to do it somewhere else in Belgium. But they were like dead set on doing it in Brussels.
So. And who's the other partner, the guy that makes a Zinne beer? What's his name? Pietra? Peter?
I think that's right. I don't remember now.
I can't commit.
I just read the article
and
I forgot.
But De La Zen's on. Do they make Taras Bulba too? Is that
yes,
the
they
same?
Do.
Yes, they do.
Oh,
Taras Bulba.
That's my favorite, like, kind of low strength, super hot, dry, hoppy.
Session beer.
And Yvonne is an expert on saisons and Belgian wit beers and has written chapters and books and all sorts of things. So that's his area of expertise. And then, of course, Jean Van Roy, who is the brewmaster of Cantillon, is a master of lambics, traditional spontaneous fermented, you know, lambics. And so get the two guys together and it's magic.
Yvonne's also a real fan of English ales, too. He loves.
I knew you were going to get that in there.
Session ales.
He's a fan of good beer, but he is an opinionated guy.
Oh
so.
God, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No,
he's
do you
great
like
to
him?
Talk to. Yeah.
Yeah, we traveled around Belgium and France together in Germany, and he's always got something to say about beer, and I was like wondering if he was going to let me be in the car with him because he's like, if you don't like good beer, like you're just like off the boat. You're just off
He'll
the
just
boat.
Throw you out.
Yeah.
So, like, you, Dan Shelton, and him together in the car, that would be something. I'd like to see that. I'd pay money for that.
We had a camera rolling.
Yeah, I bet you did.
So, yeah, it's great. It's
So just
it's
say sour. The name of the beer again, because this is really pretty unique.
Wadesda? Wadesda. And I'm not sure what that means, but it's number one. So it sounds like it's, I think on here it says something about a series of De La Zen adventures. So it sounds like they're out to collaborate a little bit, but I know if they're going to collaborate, they're only going to collaborate with
So De La Zen, it's one of the really one of my favorite breweries, and now it's a brewery, and it's imported by Shelton Brothers, sheltonbrothers.com.
Right. And didn't Yvonne used to brew the XX Bitter with Durang?
Yeah, he
too?
Sure did.
Yeah,
he's brewed for
he's
a long time.
Wow,
history.
Really?
Yeah.
XX Bitter, that's another one of my favorite.
And he's all
beers.
About bringing, you know, he's... and Ray probably heard a lot about this when he was driving with him, but he's very much into getting Belgium back to where it once was.
Oh, yeah.
Not so, these big fruit sugar bombs.
He's a real purist.
Yeah, he's definitely traditional.
Dryer.
And he names names.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We're not going to do that here, though.
No.
Well, hey, cool. We just have another special guest just join us. We're going to take a break in a few minutes, but Bill Herlicka, he's the brewer from White Birch up in Hooksett, New Hampshire. He just joined us. Bill, how are you?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. How about you guys?
I how are you, Bill?
Too far away from the mic.
All right.
I'm great.
But
how
not
about
anymore.
You guys?
Yeah, Bill's been on the show. We did a telephone, or is it telephone call? Is that
telephone.
How and we're taking a little break in a few minutes, and happy to have you here, man.
No,
I'm looking forward to trying your beers, and I think you compliment this show nicely. So we'll take a short break. In just a moment, we'll talk more with our guests, Dave Jen and Bill Herlicka, when we come back on Beer Sessions Radio.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained, and rode us all the way to New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues. Windshield wipers slapping time, I was holding Bobby's tandem mat. We sang every song that Javi knew. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, I mean nothing, honey, if it ain't free. Good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby, yeah.
Kentucky coal mine to the California sun. Hey, Bobby shared the secrets of my soul. Through all kinds of weather, through everything.
Welcome back
done
to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We've been talking a lot about GreatBrewers.com Beer Sommelier feature, which allows users to get beer pairing ideas based on what they might be serving. Another great way to use Beer Sommelier is in conjunction with Beer Cloud, their great app. So check out GreatBrewers.com and learn more about Beer Cloud and Beer Sommelier. At GreatBrewers.com, it's all about the brewers. So we're here with Bill Hurlicka from White Birch Brewing, and Dave Broderick and Jen Schwartman and Ray Dieter and Jimmy Carboni. And we're just digging this beer, man.
This beer is so good. What do you think, Bill?
Oh, I'm loving it. You know, one of the things I love about a real wild like this, it's taken time to get that flavor out there. You can, if you go to a festival, as much as I hate to say it, you can taste a beer that's labeled wild that's been, you know, a month or 2 months or with lactic acid. And with the rise in popularity in these things, when you have something like this, it really just shines on what this is supposed to be about versus some of the ones that come out as shortcuts. So, thank you.
You know what this reminds me of a little bit? When I first opened up DBA almost 1,000 years ago, there was Gutenbond. You remember Gutenbond?
Mm.
It was really, really good.
Yeah, Leafman's.
Leafman's Gutenbond. And
it's coming back, by the way.
Well, I keep on hearing rumors of that. We'll see. This is, I think, is better, but it kind of has that maltiness mixed with that great lactic sourness that you associate with a Canteon or a Lambic Ale. Great balance. And we were talking about this during the break. I'm not the biggest fan of the barrel-aged beers, but the subtlety of this is amazing. Yeah. He just made it work so well.
Yeah, it's a nuance instead.
A nuance.
A flavor.
Yeah. Chen, since we're back from the break, could you tell us what the name of this beer is again?
Oh, yeah, sure. The Breweries de la Seine, which is, that Seine is S-E-N-N-E. So that's a brewery that makes a lot of its own beers. Terrace Bulba, we've mentioned, some great things. But this is a collaboration called the Wadesda Number 1. And
we
I don't
like
know.
Just like hearing you say that.
Yeah, he's
one more time.
You guys are making fun of me.
Well, it's the only time we ever impressed Jen with a beer. And I'm enjoying this beer.
Ray just asked for more.
I know.
Bill, how can we go from De La Seine to White Birch?
Well,
you got some good beers for us tonight too?
Well, since we're starting wild, I suggest we go to the Night Falls. What you'll find is you get a nice sort of raspberry and chocolate going
Bill,
on.
Bill, you're not intimidated, are you?
No.
But you can stand right up with this stuff.
Hey, you know?
I'm looking forward to it.
Why not?
Bill, we've been lucky enough to have tried some of your beers. You did an event at Blind Tiger not too long ago. You did a call-in on Beer Sessions Radio. I'm of the opinion that you are really a on your way to becoming a master of bottle-conditioned beer. Is that really a focus of what you're doing?
It is. I've been bottle-conditioning beers for 17 years. 14 years after I've been doing it, I realized what I was doing wrong with kegs, which was leaving the CO2 line on. They all went flat, which is why I got so frustrated with them. Honestly, I think a bottle-conditioned beer lasts longer.
Hey, Bill, why don't you explain to all of our Blue Moon drinkers out there what a bottle-conditioned beer is?
Sure. Bottle-conditioned beer is carbonated through the use of adding sugar to the beer, letting the yeast convert that sugar to CO2. So it produces a softer bubble than a forced carbonated beer. It's really rare that you see a beer done forced carbonated and then have a chance to try it naturally carbonated. I think probably the only one you might be able to try would be a Dogfish Head, the Squall IPA, and the 60 Minute.
You know, I'm pretty sure that actually Sierra Nevada is bottle conditioned.
It is. The pale ale, absolutely. I've had it from the tank, and it's flat. It's delicious and fresh, but flat because it doesn't gain its carbonation until it's in the bottle. And that's why you can also, if you're a home brewer, that's one of the classic beers where they protected their proprietary yeast for a long time, and then they got to a point where they were like, "We don't have to protect it. What are we doing?" And there's yeast in the bottle. You can propagate that, and you can actually use their yeast strain, and it can.
A lot of home brewers do that.
About pale.
A lot of home brewers will propagate their own yeast from their Okay, what is this beer that we're being handed right now?
Well, this is called Night Falls. This was a blend of Rye 4, which is a Rye Quad, and
Rye Elysium. Quad?
Yeah.
Explain.
Well, take a strong golden Belgian beer, cross it with rye, make it about 11.5%, and then take that, about 60% of a whiskey barrel, fill the other half up with an imperial stout, put some wild cultures in it, let it gel and have fun for about 10 months, and then bottle it.
Okay, so quad is short for?
Quadruple.
Quadruple, okay. That's all I was asking.
Belgian quadruple. Yeah.
Now, in Belgium, do they really make quadruples? I thought that's more of like a marketing strategy. And the doubles and triples were traditional.
No, they definitely make quadruples.
Well, doesn't La Trappe have a quadruple?
Yeah. La Trappe quad.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It does. Yeah.
That's Chimay Blue.
No, it's not a quad.
It's not a quad?
No.
What about St. Bernardus ABT 12? Is that a quadruple?
Yes.
Yes, thank you.
You made that up. Is it really?
No. Yeah. Well, quad is more of an American term. I haven't really seen the term quad on a lot of bottles.
You see, how do you say quad in Flemish?
Well, I only speak English, so I would just say quad in another country.
All right, let's taste this beer.
All right. Wow. We're having fun today. You know, that first beer from De La Sena, I am just still digging it, man. That is like so cool. I'm like, I really like beer.
We're moving on. We're going to support Bill here and try his beer too.
Well, one thing, everyone in this room here, we the bar owners here, we really make our, I think we make our livings from draft beer. And I've always been such a big fan of draft beer, but the more I try certain beers like this De La Sen beer in bottle with a cork, and Bill's a nice little rye quadruple here and his double that I had this weekend, you know, there's something to say about bottle conditioned beers.
Yeah, it's good.
And I think you can get them in your home too. You know, you can buy them. And
also,
especially if they're traveling a long way.
Right.
You know, it's like sometimes it's better in the bottle, especially bottle conditioned.
Well, a lot of the Belgian beers that we have on draft here in the States are just traditional. They're only for export. They don't. You can't find. I don't think you can find Chimay draft in Belgium, or at least never used to be able to.
I think that they just put. Yeah, they just recently kegged that trip with a triple for basically our market, I think.
Yeah, because we're such a draft-driven market.
Right.
They knew that. They actually had to change the recipe to do it.
You know, I like Chimay, but I don't pour their stuff on draft because I don't think that's the right presentation.
You're a purist.
We've been over this before, Ray. You know? Like.
The beer actually changes when you're talking about bottle-conditioned beers and the package sizes. I mean, I did an experiment back home. 12-ounce bottles, 16-ounce bottles, 22-ounce bottles. And the 12-ounce bottles, if you're blindfolded or I bring it to you blind, you wouldn't realize it was the same beer. The taste is just that dramatic.
So size does matter when it comes to beer.
I think there's a pun there, but yeah. You know, and when you take one of these beers, and if you've really spent a lot of time packaging it in 750s or 22s, and that's how you want the beer to taste, then you turn around and you put it in a keg. Well, now the volume of the keg is a heck of a lot larger in your 22, and that also winds up impacting the flavor. What I found
is pretty interesting.
It softens the beer some. For some styles, that can be a great thing, but in other beers, you actually can potentially take away from what the brewer intended.
So it's almost like if you're baking, you might have a recipe for a cupcake that might be different than a cake, right?
Yeah.
And that's really what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Or another question. I know that White Birch just went through a major expansion, right?
Absolutely.
And so the question, I can't remember, it was a really small brewery before. How many, what was it, like a half barrel or something brewery? It was tiny.
A carboy.
It was a carboy brewery. And now it's, what, 7 barrels? Where did it start? I forget how big it was.
I started at 15 to 20 gallons at a time.
There you go.
And I had a pallet of 30 carboys when I got going. Now we're at 7 barrels. And, you know, there's certainly been some challenges. I mean,
so my question is, just like we're talking about the cupcake to cake ratio and the small bottle to larger bottle ratio, how is the interpretation of a super small brewery up to, like, you know, the how was your transition from with your recipes from one size brewery to another? It seems like that might also not be
a linear
progression. There's an interpretation when you're talking about volume.
Well, it was a couple of recipes translated perfectly. A couple others, we have Ragan here. Boy, let me tell you, there's nothing like looking at 800 pounds of grain and nothing draining. Some of the things that worked perfect at 20 gallons just did not translate up. So what we had to do was, once we finished a 16-hour day, step back, take a look at what we were trying to get for flavors out of the beer, come back to it. The overriding principle for me is I'm not going to short a beer to try and save $5, you know, or scale it up to 7 barrels, $100. You know, the results are what I'm looking for. So we've changed things around a little bit, notably some of the high concentrations of wheat don't actually meld well, and 800 pounds doesn't work in our brew system. So we make things sometimes
live
in two batches.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I got to say, this beer that we're drinking right now, all the elements that you spoke of earlier, I can taste the stout, I can taste the rye, I can taste...
I smell the stout. The that smells like stout, and then you put it on your tongue, and it completely changes.
Yeah, and it sounds intimidating. It sounds very complicated, and it is complex, but it's so accessible and really delicious.
Thank you. When I told some people what I had done, some of my friends, they looked at me sideways going, that is not going to work. I'm like, you know, if it doesn't, it's my fault.
You know, on the nose, I get like a hint of oxidation, just a hint, but just a little bit. But I'm not getting it in the mouth at all.
Hmm. Bill, I'm going to ask you a question that I've asked a couple other small brewers who aren't from New York. Is why are you coming into the New York market when you're still so small? I know just last week there was one of the salesmen from your distributor, Union Beer, said, oh, we've got all these different, you know, white birch beers in bottle, and I put in an order, and I was lucky to get I got one case of your double, which I loved. You know, why are you moving into New York now? Why don't you wait a while?
Excuse me. It's a great question. You know, I think there's a lot to be learned from different markets. I make a niche product. I recognize I make a niche product. In some ways, you know, New Hampshire is behind the scenes in Massachusetts, New York, Philly. In other ways, there's certainly an enthusiast culture there for bottled beer. What I find is beers I can put on draft down here, down in Philly, people have become used to beers like that. The same beers I put on tap in New Hampshire don't necessarily move as fast. And it's not that the beer is bad. It's just, you know, we're still used to the heavy IPA or...
And that consumer base isn't quite there yet. Is that what you're saying?
They're not there.
Right. So it's I talk about the collective palate of the consumer, and they've got to drive their brewers. It has to be a partnership.
You need to move to Vermont. Sorry, dude.
where in New Hampshire are you?
I'm up in Hooksett. Go to Manchester, hang a right. And as far as Vermont, if it weren't for all the taxes over in Vermont, you know, that might have been a place I'd moved to 20 years ago.
Live free or die.
I forgot about those taxes. Yeah, you're right.
No, I mean, New Hampshire's a great state, but, you know, we don't have public transportation like you do down here. I mean, I went the wrong way on the subway once, and people were nice enough to at least answer, am I going the right way? And shake their heads, but I got here. You know, in New Hampshire, I'm driving a half hour. So when you go out to drink at a bar, you know, you're thinking about how far you have to drive. And so milder session beers tend to rule the roost. The take-home market, the bottles, you know.
Bill, you got to fire up your GPS, man. You got to fire up your GPS. Find out where you're going.
Doesn't sober you up, Ray. Come on.
Hey, by GPS, it was 5.5 hours to get here.
Well, are all listeners 21 and over? That's important.
You
same
must
kind
be
of thing.
21
if
years of age.
Got to be 21 and over to check out some beer sites, and you got to be careful when you're driving. In
all you kids out there,
so.
Turn off.
So,
turn
Bill,
off
what
the
should
computer.
We have next?
Well, I would suggest, since we started with Night Falls, to go to the Indulgence. We'll take you off the wild, go with a pitch black Belgian ale. You know, nice notes of chocolate, very smooth. And then we can take you over to the Rigen and finish on a rye note.
All right. We're going to check out the White Birch Indulgence. We're going to take a short break in a moment. We'll be back with our guests, Dave, Jan, and Bill, when we come back on Beer Sessions Radio.
Chewing on a piece of grass, walking down the road. Tell me, how long you gonna stay here, Joe? Some people say this town don't look good in snow. You don't care, I know. Ventura Highway in the sunshine, where the days are longer, the nights are stronger than moonshine. You're gonna go, I know. Surround your daylight there. Seasons crying, no despair. Alligator lizards in the air.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Sunday at 4:30 p.m., tune in to Burning Down the House. Architecture is the laser focus of Burning Down the House, a weekly discourse on all things built, destroyed, admired, and despised. Each week, Curtis B. Wayne, your host, invites a posse of authors, critics, builders, designers, and other architecture fiends to reflect on various topics related to perhaps the most functional of all art forms. Again, that's every Sunday at 4:30 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
All right, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. We've got a very cool group here, and we got an email question. We got Bill Herlico from White Birch Brewing. A very interesting dude making some cool beers up in Hooksett, New Hampshire. Did you have to drive here or did you take public transportation?
I drove down to Mass and picked up the Acela. That was a beautiful way to come into the city.
So you still have to drive to get out of New Hampshire?
Well, there's only one way to get here from there.
The Acela does have a bar car. I know that for a fact.
I'm sorry?
The Acela does have a bar car, too.
They do, but they don't have White Birch on it.
Well, you got to figure that out.
Do they sell beer in the bar car?
Yeah,
Heineken,
they do.
Sam Adams.
Forget that. That's boring. All right. Here's a question for Bill. Someone actually wrote in a question for you. This is from Aaron Ouellette. I don't know where he's from, but Aaron, thank you so much for writing in. As a commercial brewer, are you a commercial brewer? How do you feel about clone recipes, and what are your thoughts about home brewers cloning their favorite beers and sharing their recipes? As a follow-up, I'm trying to get a better understanding how all the aspects of brewing affect the beer. Beyond your starting ingredients, what do you consider the most overlooked part of brewing?
Wow.
Heavy stuff.
Well, that's a lot of questions.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks for writing in.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. I am a commercial brewer. I do pay taxes. That's a big difference between home brewing. You know, clone recipes, if that's really your thing, go for it. I mean, that's the beauty of home brewing. It's like cooking at home. You can make anything you want, however you want. If you really are focused on a clone recipe, as long as you're not trying to do it to save money, I say knock your socks off. I've had some amazing clones of commercial beers, and because they're fresh, they blow the doors off of anything I can get from the store. Probably the biggest thing I'd focus on, aside from trying to figure out what's the right grain bill, is your yeast and fermentation temp. All too often, beers are made with simple, clean finishing yeast that don't add anything to the beer. Making a beer is kind of like cooking or painting. There's a broad stroke of colors, there's a broad stroke of ingredients that you can bring to the process, and if you're shortcutting your beer by using just a simple, basic yeast, unless that's what the recipe's calling for, then you may really be missing out on making a killer beer.
All right. Here's another question. This is from our producer, Bree O'Connor. What have been the biggest challenges in terms of getting your brewery off the ground?
Sticking to what you find is most important to you. You know, I laugh. When I started with three stores. My dad and my brothers are going, "What are you doing? You need to make more beer. You can't have three stores. No one's going to keep coming back." I'm like, "This is where we're starting, and this is how we're going to go." I had someone I talked to who said, "You know, you should think about contract brewing, because then, you know, you got a great logo, you got a great look, and now you can tap into someone else's excess capacity." And I appreciated the advice and thanked them for it and asked them if they knew of anyone that contract brewed that did bottle conditioned beer. And he said, no. I said, exactly. So, you know, I think consumers really, you know, buy into what they like and want to feel a part of a brewery and what a brewery holds important. And if you say, these are the five things, these are the three things that I think are most important, and you stick to that, then people appreciate that. I mean, we started the show on this amazing wild beer. Wild beers can be hard to get. The supply is very limited. It's not an easy beer to make, and it takes a ton of time. You know, if they cut the wild aging process and put lactic acid in the beer, sure, it's going to taste sour, but it's not going to taste the same. So I think in terms of managing the brewery and getting up to where we wanted to be, it's sticking to what we held as important and not shortcutting those ideals to try and do things cheaper or faster.
Okay. So, Bill, we just got a new beer here. There's a new stout that we're drinking.
The Indulgence.
The Indulgence.
Explain this one again.
Well, I had to move some wooden shelves from one end of the brewery to the other. I'd over-ordered a ton of chocolate malt. I got a little over ambitious, or I was drinking when I ordered one of the two. And
we should explain real fast about chocolate malt. It's not actually chocolate. There's no chocolate in the malt. It's just a roasted barley to the color of chocolate.
Correct. So my option was cough, or take the malt off the shelf, disassemble the shelves. I didn't have a lot of space. Cut the shelves down, reassemble, and move the malt again. Or I could make a beer. So basically what I did was I took our house Belgian yeast, an insane amount of chocolate malt, built a beer around the chocolate malt to bring in a roasty, chocolatey, almost coffee-like expression of the beer. I don't call it a stout because stout's typically made with chocolate malt, black patent, and roasted barley.
I got a question. You said your house Belgian yeast.
Yes.
That sounds like almost like an oxymoron. Your house is in New Hampshire. But
sure.
So how does that work?
Well, I've been brewing for 17 years. I've been playing with yeast. I have a yeast farm.
Proprietary.
Just cultivated.
You've got a yeast farm.
Yeah.
That is something I've never heard of before.
Why wouldn't I have a yeast farm?
I mean, I know that, like, I saw an interview with Six Point, and I know he said he had, like, his own house yeast that he was working with, and now I think they're going to break out and try some different things. I mean, do you have different... How many different house yeasts do you have?
Well, we have one primary yeast that we use in everything we call Belgian style. We use about 7 or 8 different yeast, depending on what we're trying to do. And then we have 12 different wild cultures that we have.
And you would use more than one yeast in one beer?
Oh, sure. Sure.
Uh-huh. And how does that work? How does that work?
Well, it's like putting sugar and cream in your coffee. Or just doing one or the other. Each yeast brings a different aspect to the beer.
And at what point do you add it?
For the most part, we'll add yeast at the beginning to start fermentation,
mm-hmm.
one or more to bring out a blend. The Berliner Weiss that we're brewing right now, we put in lactobacillus and a German ale yeast. We put them in at the same time and let them duke it out in the fermenter. When we do something wild like Night Falls, we'll let the beer condition, we'll put it in the barrels, and then we'll add a blend of wild cultures into the barrel and then just let it go for 6 to 12 months before we sample it.
Are all of your yeast strains wild then?
No.
So is it hard to keep them separate from each other without contamination?
No.
Okay. I was just curious because it seems like those, there's a reason why those yeast strains are called wild.
Right. How do you tame the wild yeast?
Yeah.
You don't. You just keep it separated from the rest.
Bill, one reason we had you on is it's like this kind of excitement about all these new small breweries. And I know Dave and Jen, especially at Blind Tiger, seem to have a great affinity for discovering what's new, or maybe the new breweries go to Blind Tiger. What do you guys think about White Birch in general?
Yeah, it's great to have another brewery that's ambitious and doing some really different things. I mean, these beers are unlike anything else I've tried. And we haven't seen a whole lot coming out of New Hampshire lately, so it's fun to see another beer enter the market that's pretty local and doing something new.
Yeah, it's and the small breweries can do a lot of different things. You know, it's he's not doing 50 barrel batches, so he can sort of play around and express himself maybe a lot more than a larger brewery could. But yeah, definitely, especially with New Hampshire, we're kind of, besides Smutty, we're really looking for, new breweries to come out of there. And so it's nice to see somebody really doing some interesting stuff.
Dave, what are some of the other newer and or smaller breweries that you've had a chance to work with at Blind Tiger that you really like that we should know about?
On Wednesday, actually, we're doing our Vermont Beer and Cheese Festival. So we've got four really tiny breweries that they're going to be represented there. You know, Hill Farmstead, who just came into the market from the Northeast Kingdom, and The Alchemist, which is up in Waterbury, and Lawson's Finest, who's a one-barrel brewery up in the Mad River Valley, and Zero Gravity from American Flatbread up in Burlington. So
it's going to be good.
Yeah, it's just, again, it's the same thing. You know, same thing that Bill's doing is these guys, because they're so tiny, they have developed, and because they're so Vermont, and they've developed a real Vermont sensibility, like it's almost like a terroir, with a wine. And so, each one is really working with local ingredients and having a lot of fun with it and kind of finding themselves where they are, and that the water that they use and they're really big on water. So, I really think that they're kind of, it's just like, it's almost like boutique winemakers. Each one is really trying to find their own niche, just as Bill's trying to do.
All right. No, I'm learning a lot from you guys. I met some guys from North Carolina not too long ago. Your Mother Earth brewery.
Earth, yeah. There's quite a few. Duck Rabbit down there. Paul's doing some great stuff. Front Street. Kevin down there is doing great stuff.
North Carolina is exploding. Lived there for 2 years in the late 90s, and there was very little going on there.
I think
it's changed.
They?
Well, I think.
I don't know if they had to pop the cap. South Carolina did for sure.
By pop the cap?
Well, a lot of the southern states had alcohol limits on beer.
I remember
Vermont had 8%, and they popped the cap a couple of years ago, and that really changed things a lot. South Carolina had 6%. North Carolina, I don't remember what if they had a cap or what it was.
Yeah, they did have one, because I remember going down there and. Yeah.
But that wasn't the only problem. There just weren't a lot of breweries down there, and I was even involved loosely in the beer industry down there, and it was really limited. And then I haven't been back, so I assumed that, oh yeah, nothing's going on down there. And then I've heard it's one of, especially the Asheville area, apparently,
yeah,
is one
like
of the
10,
hottest
10
markets.
Breweries wow. in, just
I can't
in
wait
Asheville
to get back and visit some people.
And you would think that makes sense, because in the south it's south and it's warmer down there. It's like definitely beer drinking climate.
And but it's interesting because with Duck Rabbit, they're Paul didn't know what his flagship was going to be. He just sort of started making beers and put them out there, and it ended up being his milk stout, which is like the last thing you would expect in a warm climate state.
Right, right, right.
In the humidity.
So it's really interesting like what people are gravitating towards down there. But Foothills down there is doing some great, award-winning stuff. And you've got these young guns that are, coming out. This guy Ryan, who I met up in Vermont, came out of Duck Rabbit and now is over in Europe. Running a brewery over there. So, you know, he's in his 20s. You got a lot of young guys that are coming. The next generation is coming out of these
as these laws change, you see the whole culture changing down there. I mean, Florida's got some great beers. Cigar City is making great stuff.
And Saint somewhere.
Yep. I mean, and Florida's rules were ridiculous. It was the size of the bottle.
There used to be on the bottle caps in Florida, it would say FL. There was specific beer going to Florida, and it's my understanding, I spent some time in Florida in the 90s, and it was my understanding that
you
was
get
because
around, Jen.
Well, and I asked, and I think it was because it was a notorious dump site of rejected beer. And so to protect themselves, there was beer that was designated to go to Florida. So you couldn't just take the beer from other markets and just drop it off in Florida.
But also, where we dump our old people.
But also Florida is basically owned by Anheuser-Busch. Like, you know, if you go to Busch Gardens,
yeah
that's it's a beer garden for children. It's great. They have like this whole like daycare center where they teach little kids how to drink beer properly. It's really, I brought my kids there.
Aww.
Yeah, it was adorable. It's all called right. Beer School. And I'm not joking either.
Beer School for kids.
Yeah. Beer School like for that. Children in
Well, guys,
Florida.
You know what? This conversation is leading to a... Let's go around the room and everybody tell us their favorite beer from the weekend. Ray, what was your favorite beer from the weekend?
You know, Jimmy, I told you I was down in New Orleans, Louisiana, and I got to say that I was drinking a lot of bourbon. I know you hate when I say that, but I was drinking bourbon down in New Orleans.
Bill, from New Hampshire?
That was my Nightfalls that I enjoyed a lot this weekend.
All right. Dave?
And actually, when I was picking up some of the kegs in Vermont this weekend, I stopped in to see Paul Saylor at American Flatbread, and he let me taste some of his beers. And his Maybach was beautiful. I really liked that.
And Jen from Blind Tiger?
Great Divides Espresso Yeti. So it was the Yeti, which is a great imperial stout they do. And then this was the one with the coffee in it. It was delicious.
And at Jimmy's number 43, we had White Birch Double in bottle conditioned. It was pretty awesome. So, guys, thanks so much for coming around. This is a Good Beer Seal events this week. Tonight, the Pony Bar is hosting the Trogue event. Saturday, February 26th, the Pony Bar's Pony Express. And all weekend long, Rattle and Hum is hosting a very special cask event. Monday, February 28th, Jimmy's number 43 and Six Point Craft Ales are teaming up for a special beer dinner. And you can check out all the other Good Brew Seal events at goodbrewseal.com. I'd like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com. Thank you so much. And thanks to Ray, Dave, Jen, and Bill for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carbone. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Bree O'Connor. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio.
In my songs, I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Momofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's M-O-F-A-D dot
eventbrite.com. Once again, MOFAD.EVENTBRITE.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.
When you open the bottle and you drink the wine, it speaks for itself. Is it, you know, a wine that's made for food? Yes. Those types of wines tend to be more rustic or have a little bit more body. Are there wines that are just pure out hedonistic pleasure? Sure, there's wines like that that maybe from California that are more cocktail wines, or wines that are just big jammy fruit bombs. And those, I think, appeal to a certain group of people as well. I think the wines that Barterhouse specializes in is more of these food-friendly, you know, rustic style, biodynamic, organic wines that tend to be a bit more earthy, come from someplace. So you can almost taste the terroir. You can almost feel this guy, this Sancerre, was grown in this slaty, rocky soil. And so to me, that's the exciting part, that the wine feels like it comes from someplace.